This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
This is Radio EcoShock. Our guest is Peter Ward, paleontologist and professor of biology, as well as earth and space sciences at the University of Washington in Seattle. Peter last joined us on our December 9th, 2008 program for a discussion of his book, Under a Green Sky. Now he's back with a new idea, sure to rattle a lot of people. It's called the Medea Hypothesis. Peter Ward, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
And thanks so much for having me again.
Well, your new book picks a fight with a beloved scientist, Sir James Lovelock. Can you explain Lovelock's Gaia Hypothesis, and then we'll get to your answer to it?
Yeah, the Gaia Hypothesis is really a wonderfully introspective, I would say, from both a mental and a psychological point of view, hypothesis about how the world works and how nature works. And introspective in the sense that it has, by itself, entirely spawned what we call New Age or New World religions. It really has a sense that the Earth is alive, and or the Earth and its systems act in such a way to better or optimize the planet for life itself.
And I gather that it's now split up into two versions that you take on in your book.
Yeah, there's always been an extreme fringe, and Lovelock himself is really one of the amazing intellects of the 20th century, although for a variety of reasons, I think some of his 21st century ideas are getting increasingly batty, and I'll go into these in a minute. But it also split off into the whole New Age business, which he never advocated. And the most extreme view of Gaia is that the Earth itself, including all the hard stuff that most of the Earth is made up of, is part of a living being, that we are one gigantic living planet with this thin veneer of gas and life itself over this much thicker, rocky planet, but the whole thing's alive. And that not even Lovelock himself really advocates that, although in the past he's dabbled in that. The other is that there are many systems equivalent to, say, our organ systems or our blood system, which maintain life, and that through time the whole makes it better for the individual.
And I guess that even that branch has split into that which optimizes the planet for life and that which merely regulates the planet somehow using biological means so that life can continue.
Yeah, that's really, you've hit it beautifully, actually. That really is the division that goes on. How much is optimization? How much is just letting life continue? I don't think anyone argues with the fact that life influences the planet. It influences geology. It influences the gas of the atmosphere. It has all of these effects on the physical world, and that obviously vice versa, the physical world has effects on biology. That's almost the weakest kind of Gaia hypothesis, is that there is this interaction. No one disputes that. On the other hand, the sense that life itself is making the world better for future life is the other aspect, and that's really where James Lovelock is. It's kind of like you buy a house and or rent a hotel room, if you will, and then while you're there in that hotel, you paint it and clean it up and put in new furniture and spend all this money on it so that the next guest has even a better hotel room. I mean, that's not really what a lot of us think that life is doing here.
So by contrast to that, what is the Medea hypothesis?
Well, Medea is the worst Greek mother, because Gaia is the name that Lovelock came up with for the good mother, and it was the Greek idea of good mother Earth. And I just almost tongue-in-cheek, but not too much, came up with this idea of Medea. And from Greek literature, we know of Jason and the Golden Fleece. He ran off with King Aetes, who had stolen the fleece, his daughter Medea, married Medea, and Jason, it turns out, was a pretty good captain and a really bad husband. And Medea, in a fit of pique, murdered their children several years later when Jason found himself flirting with other queens. So if you want a bad mother, Medea is probably about the worst. And the sense is not so tongue-in-cheek. Because of the mass extinctions and other episodes in Earth history, Mother Earth has murdered her children over and over and over again.
And I remember in your book, Under a Green Sky, you came to this chunk of rock that looked like about, if I remember correctly, about 10 million years, where there was practically not much alive left in the fossil record, at least. That must be very startling to look at.
Oh, absolutely. And those were the seeds that brought Medea, at least in my own mind, to life, is when you look at these long intervals of time after mass extinction, it sure doesn't look like life has been optimizing the planet for much of anything. We really go back to a microbial world, and we have a sense that It's not getting better. It's just getting worse. And when life does come back, it's different life. I mean, you can't say better, you can't say worse, but you can certainly say different.
One of the great things about this book, in my opinion, is your ability to summarize and teach us the latest cutting-edge earth science. There have been some really remarkable discoveries just in the last couple of years. I'd like to get into some of that brain food. But could you start by explaining what you see as a possible flaw in evolution that could end up wrecking our living planet?
Well, it's funny you say that. It was one of the first lectures I gave about this. I gave a trial tune-up to my department, which is composed of a lot of really good biologists, and one of the best, a man named Joe Felsenstein, who's a National Academy member evolutionist, sort of raised his hand up and said, well, you know, after you've given this presentation and knowing what I know about life, you're giving way too much chops to this Medea. I think evolution is really kind of a dumb tinkerer and kind of blunders from place to place. And he suggested that I call it not the Medea hypothesis, but the Mr. Bean hypothesis, that evolution is just this dumb blunderer, and that actually might be a much better sense of what happens, is that there are these evolutionary breakthroughs, and sometimes they're better for the species, more often they're worse, but quite often they have an effect on the entire ecosystem. A new species doesn't care what it does to anything else. It just wants to reproduce, make more of itself. We talk about the selfish gene. Well, I think we really need to talk about the selfish species.
I guess we're a prime example, but also some of the bacteria would take over if they could.
Absolutely, and they've been here before. They will be here again. There is a certain definite finite limit to the age of animals, just that is dictated by the nature of our enlarging sun, by the nature of an aging earth. Everything's finite. Well, so too is the age of animals, and the bacteria are laying in wait to take back the planet that advanced animal life took from them 500 million years ago.
Well, I'd also like to imagine a mass extinction caused by a greenhouse effect. I don't think the public has any idea of what that might be like. Can you give us some clues of what happened?
Yeah, when I wrote Under a Green Sky, I tried to put out some op-ed pieces or something about this, and I was sort of viewed as a fringe lunatic, and that although that may definitely still be the case, finally, actually, some people are waking up because of a whole raft of independent studies, both from the past mass extinctions, but what is happening on our planet today. I mean, I suggest that a greenhouse extinction just occurs when the planet warms up enough that the poles and the tropics are so similar in temperature that it slows down ocean currents. Slowing ocean currents causes the ocean to lose its oxygen. An oxygen-free ocean spawns a group of bacteria that animals don't like. In fact, these bacteria can kill off animals. Well, we're starting to see that right now. We have a warming poles, and the poles are warming radically faster than the tropics. Tropics just can't warm much warmer. The poles can warm up all the way to the temperature of the tropics. And so you have this asymmetry. The asymmetry is causing the heat difference between the polar regions and the equator to drop, and as that drops, there's less impetus for wind and current. As things stagnate, oxygen stops being pumped into the ocean. And there you go. So NASA got hold of this. A bunch of us were taken down to NASA Ames at the behest of the director there, saying, look, is this a bunch of nonsense or is it possible? And 15 scientists were invited, and every one of them stood up and said, you know, this is looking pretty bad. In fact, it's looking like it could happen way faster than anybody's suggesting, including a slowdown to the point of near cessation of the Pacific gyres starting next century. So it's definitely happening.
Well, I thought about you and your theory when I was listening to a lecture, one of the lectures at the Oxford Beyond 4 Degrees Climate Conference that was just held at the end of September, and Professor John Schellenhuber was talking about oxygen-free zones that were developing in the Indian Oceans at key levels where fish would live. And I thought, whoa, I wonder if that's the beginning of this.
It absolutely is. I mean, that conference scared everybody because simply the fact that there would be 4 degrees, and that's 4 degrees centigrade, by 2060, it has to be such a wake-up call. And yet the United States right now is so tied up in blocking health care, there's no conversation about a far more important bill in my mind, which is the climate bill, the climate change bills. Those things are just stalled. And we are I mean, we really are facing some very bad times, not for us. I mean, everybody who hears this program, we're fine. Our children and their children and their children are not going to be fine.
Well, all this leads to one of the central messages of your book, which I think will confuse some people. For me, I was reading it in the long past and in the long future. The real threat is not increasing carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, but dropping levels of CO2. Could you explain that for us?
I know. Nature is just full of irony. I think it's the most delicious, but most frustrating of all aspects of the universe, I think. Yeah, the irony is that over the long period of time, what's going to doom animal life isn't too much CO2, but not enough. It turns out that animals, and this is one of the things I point out in the book, is that life is taking so much carbon dioxide and putting it in places where it can no longer be recycled that a half billion years from now, there cannot be more animals on this planet because we're going to lose all plant life. And once we lose plant life, we'll lose animal life soon after. And it's simply because every time you look at a mountain that's white, made of limestone, you're looking at a whole lot of carbon that life has taken out of the atmosphere by producing skeletons and then simply deposited in places where it cannot be recycled. We are doing just the opposite right now. We're taking carbon out of rock and putting it back in the atmosphere. And that's something in the long term we humans will have to do. I think we have it as a species to be able to regulate the carbon in our atmosphere to maintain animal life on this particular planet for billions of years. But right now, the short-term threat is too much carbon in the atmosphere. And then the long-term threat is not enough. And what we are doing right now is squandering our bank account of carbon that we're really going to need in the hundreds of millions of years to come.
You're listening to Radio EcoShock on Green 960 AM, San Francisco. We're talking with Peter Ward about his book, The Medea Hypothesis. Peter, in this work, you also gave me my first image of the natural future of this planet and the time limit that all life lives under. You just referred to it. How long have we got, Doc?
Half billion years. I was at a science fiction convention where one of the science fiction writers looked at me and said, "You've got to be kidding." And I said, "Why?" She said, "Well, why would anybody care about a half billion years from now?" And my thought was, well, look, you know, there's no reason that species have to go extinct. We don't have a gene in us that says you're going to go extinct in 2 million years. That doesn't happen. We have that aging gene that kills us, but species don't. We have bacteria on this planet that have not changed, as far as we can tell, in 3.5 billion years. And there's no reason that we as humans couldn't stay and engineer this planet until the ultimate end of Earth is going to be in 7 or 8 billion years when the sun goes red giant. But we've got billions of years if we keep our wits about us, literally.
Well, I could buy that in the long run, but I have to tell you, I'm a little worried about the call for geoengineering in the short run. Some of the right-wing think tanks and even the oil companies are getting on board with geoengineering as a way to bypass carbon controls and the Copenhagen Treaty. So and should we really turn the Earth over to the people who can't run an economy or even a train system? It worries me a bit.
Well, that worries me a lot, but let's expand the sense of geoengineering and say that planting a tree is one of the most profound and efficient methods of geoengineering. What we're talking about is changing the natural order out of what, say, Mother Nature would have produced at this moment and amplifying. I think, again, we need to regulate and we need to control our atmosphere. We need to. If I had one button that I could make that everybody on Earth ought to have, it would be save the ice sheets. I mean, nothing else. Save the ice sheets. Because as go the ice sheets, goes human civilization. If we melt any further of our Antarctic and our Greenland ice sheets, so not ice caps, anything floating on the ocean is sea level neutral, but melting the continental ice sheets causes sea level to rise or fall or rise or fall. And look, the near-term problem is we're about to head to 9 billion people. If we raise sea level even 2 meters, we've reduced an enormous amount of agriculture. So you have the intersection of 9 billion people with, say, one quarter reduction in food somewhere in the next 50 to 100 years. And that's disaster. That is total disaster. And that's really the greatest single challenge facing us is the short-term sea level rise, agriculture, and too many mouths to feed.
And the biological level, another strange idea for me in your book is that we may not be living in the great age of plant and animal life, but rather in a declining old age of life on this planet. How did I get the idea from so many scientists that we were right now at the peak, the great green golden age of life?
It's funny how all these preconceived notions just go by the wayside. When I was raised in my first classes, I always read, and even as a boy, that the way evolution worked is first there were fish, and then fish gave rise to amphibians, and we had the great age of amphibians, and then we had the age of reptiles, and then an age of mammals. And yet the fossil record tells us that the age of mammals, the first great age of mammals, preceded the dinosaurs. The mammal-like reptiles, the first true mammals of the late Permian age, were wiped out by a greenhouse extinction. Dinosaurs were just a big mistake. There should have never been this age of dinosaurs but for this very nasty, volcanically produced, very anti-Gaian, very pro-Median greenhouse extinction that ended the Permian.
Now, how do you judge things to be, just getting back to the hypothesis, how do you judge things to be Median versus Gaian, just so our listeners can tune into that idea?
Well, again, the whole Median scheme of things is that life blunders around, and that there's really no, say, planning, there's no sense of optimizing, there's no plan, if you will. Optimization indicates there's a plan somewhere, that somehow things are naturally or unnaturally running according to some plan. Well, there's no planning. I mean, evolution is just this dumb tinkerer sort of bouncing around. Things that work well do well for a while until natural changes of the planet and the system makes other things do well. But this sense that there's optimization taking place, I think, is ridiculous. And what it does, it's like a false crutch. And this is where I just am getting on the case of Dr. Lovelock, is that he has this sense now that Gaia will take care of all the human problems. And he used to say that it would be by wiping out the humans, and he keeps going back to that. I personally think we're pretty much extinction-proof. I think the technology is going to make us essentially immune to most of the things that kill most species. Now, it doesn't say extinction-proof means happy. It doesn't mean that we're going to have rich lives. It just might mean that our species goes on for a very long time. But Dr. Lovelock in Seattle was on radio saying the most unbelievable things, saying that right now China is buying up Africa because in the next 20 to 30 years, China will transfer all its population to Africa. Now, he said this publicly on the radio and then in front of a crowd. Now, he's right in saying that climate change is a big problem, but when you say that China is about to colonize Africa with a straight face, I mean, you lose a whole lot of credibility. So anyway, it just seems I'm raging against this particular machine because he's a beloved man, it's a beloved theory, and I think it really gives us a crutch that shouldn't be used.
Well, it was helping the environmental movement to be able to get people through to the idea that there's more than strip malls in your job and that, in fact, we may be connected to all of the species, that we have some sense of ourselves as life on this planet. And I don't think that would be harmful. What's your take?
No, I absolutely agree with this. I mean, we are certainly just natural creatures, but now we have technology that nothing else has had. So I hate this sense that humans are not part of the natural chain of being, but I do recognize that we do produce spaceships and we do pump carbon dioxide into the atmosphere far faster and far more vigorously than any volcano, than all the volcanoes that have ever been on the planet. It's that double-edged sword again. I think we really need to recognize the size of our footprint clunging through here. But secondly, we recognize we are on a dying planet and that either we die with it or we engineer our way through it.
So in the book, you have a little bit of a sneer for the Al Gores of this world and blast for certain kinds of back to pre-industrial life and environmentalists. Are you having a problem with some environmentalism?
Well, I have problems with the sense that people say that let's just take it back to the way it was. And if people are willing to give up the clothes that we have, the transportation, the communication, but most readily, if people are willing to see half of their babies die and die horribly from childhood diseases, if people are willing to see life expectancy go back to 35 years old and willing to see misery during that 35 years, yeah, let's go back to nature. So we're not going to do that. I think I'm a parent. Parents will just not let that happen. So let's be realists. We're not going to go back to nature. We need to contain the problems that we produce. We need to recognize what we're doing, but I think we need to be realists. And I don't think the environmental movement is being realistic about much of what it wants to do.
Well, this is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We're talking with Dr. Peter Ward about his new book, The Medea Hypothesis. I had a little bit of a problem in the book with your portrayal of nature. Naturally, your field of study has been on past mass extinctions, and you find nature can be brutal. But what about all the hundreds of millions of years where life was relatively balanced, like the age of dinosaurs, maybe? Have you forgotten about the good times here on planet Earth?
Well, maybe so. Maybe the fact that where I study and what I look at are the crises, and that the crises, when they happen, are such unbelievable wrenches to evolutionary change. Just this last week, we found the most astounding relationship between past oxygen levels and diversity of life. How many genera, really, how many species there are on the planet at any given time during animal life. And it's phenomenal. I mean, it's just an amazing correlation. When oxygen went up through natural causes, the number of species went up. When oxygen goes down, the number of species goes down. It's such a fine thing, controlling the number of species on this planet. Going back to just one or two small variables actually is very powerful, but also says that you've got a very fine, sort of fine-tuning the way life works on this particular planet. And just a slight change in one aspect, the amount of oxygen, so controls animal life. It gives a sense of how narrow things really are constructed, if constructed is the right word.
Well, as we wrap up, I'm wondering, is there something, I think it's going to take a little time, maybe a decade, for your new idea about the Medea hypothesis to get out to the public. How can we speed that up, and what do you see its role being in the current debates about climate and about life on this planet?
Well, my sense of it is that we inherited this Earth. I mean, we just sort of stumbled into this intelligence through blind, dumb evolution, and that now we understand the rules, I think, far better than any species ever has. It's really in our hands to figure out which way it's going to go. It's going to take great intelligence to get this huge swell of humanity through, I think, the next couple centuries, which are going to be awful, and try to take us to me, the sense of it is some centuries from now, we can reduce population to several billions instead of 9 to 15 billion. And we can get back to really sustainable development. And I do mean sustainable through enormous increases in technology, where we are having living houses, where we are not running these polluting cars, where we don't have to travel so much. I mean, travel is what's really killing our atmosphere. Travel and the energy needed to make the conveyances that cause the travel. See, what I think is so funny is that we humans are the only creatures that can really make the world Gaian as Lovelock wanted it to be. I mean, there could be this Gaia, and I think it is our intelligence.
We've been talking with Peter Ward. He's the author of the new book, The Medea Hypothesis, and it's published by Princeton University Press. And I notice on the inside page there, it says that you were selected by a group of scientists at the National Academy to write this book. So I think that puts you well beyond the crank level and somebody with some new things that we all need to know about. Peter Ward, thank you so much for talking with us.
And thank you for great questioning.
All right. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Download this full interview anytime as a free MP3 from our website, ecoshock.org. Next Saturday, reserve it for 350 Climate Action in San Francisco and all across the United States. Climate events will pop up all over the Bay Area on Saturday, October 24th. Go to 350.org to find one near you or start your own. Check out EcoArt Matters for Change in Berkeley, a dozen actions in Oakland, including a Climate Action mini-conference and film festival at Laney College. More happening at San Fran in The Big One, the Greenpeace Mobilization for Climate Justice. Gather at 3 p.m. at Justin Herman Plaza near the foot of Market Street to make your statement. You want to say, I do give a damn about our future climate. I'm Alex Smith. Thanks for listening.